It's Thursday, 28th of March, and this is your Capital Economics Weekly Briefing. I'm David Wilder. Coming up, Trump on the northern and southern US borders and what this election will mean for the Canadian and Mexican economies. But first, Neil Shearing's with me again to trawl through the week's big stories and pinpoint what to watch for in the coming days. How's it going, Neil?
Hi, David. Good to have you back.
Good to be back. I want to discuss our global economic outlook, but before we do that, Baltimore Bridge collapsed. Now, there's a human tragedy here with lives lost, but I do want to ask about the macro risk. Given the port's importance for handling goods trades into the US, could this put more upward pressure on inflation?
Yes, horrific scenes in Baltimore, but also some pretty alarming headlines about what this might mean for the global economy, supply chains, and like you say, inflation too. I mean, I have to say, on that front, I think they're probably a little overdone. If you look at the size of Baltimore's port, I mean, it's large, it's important, but it's the 15th largest in the US. It currently handles about 1.5% of all sea cargo in the US. So it's big, but it's not absolutely critical. And at the same time, neighboring ports in Jersey and up in New York are far less stretched. Capacity utilization in those ports is far lower than was the case a couple of years ago. So it will clearly affect some supply chains. It will have an impact on some goods markets. Coal is one, particularly coal exports to India tend to get routed through Baltimore. So that's one market worth looking at. But in a macro sense, I don't think this really moves the dial. I guess one way of thinking about it is that over the past couple of months, we've seen much greater disruption to sea freight through the Red Sea. And that's had a limited impact on global goods prices. So if disruption to container traffic through the Red Sea has not moved the dial on goods inflation, then I don't think the collapse of the Baltimore Bridge is going to do so either. If you're concerned about goods inflation and where it's going, I think the thing to keep an eye on is what's happening in China. Now, we spoke on this podcast a couple of weeks ago about how China was exporting a disinflation or deflation in global manufacturing. Actually, some of the latest data released over the past week suggests that if we look at the profit margins of Chinese industrial producers, they seem to have rebounded a little bit in the past month or so. So perhaps China may become less of a source of disinflation in global goods markets. And I think that's the key thing to keep an eye on over the coming weeks and months.
We'll get on to inflation again in a bit, but I do want to talk about our global economic outlook. It's just being published as we're speaking. This is our flagship report, captures our latest views about what's coming for major developed and emerging economies. And this latest one's got some very interesting takeaways I thought would be worth taking a bit of time to go through. Firstly, we're basically forecasting soft landings across the global economy. Now, that's after this generational spike in inflation and certainly in DMs, a belated but ultimately tough response from central banks. So is it as easy as all that? It's pretty remarkable, isn't it, given the inflation and the rate hikes that we've seen, that economies are in this state?
It is remarkable. I mean, I would push back a little against the idea that there's soft landings in every economy. I would characterize it as a soft landing in the US and broad stagnation in Europe. So we've seen recession or near recession conditions in the UK and Germany. Essentially, Europe's economy has flatlined for the best part of 18 months. And if you're a European consumer, it's felt pretty grim if you look at what's happened to household spending across Europe over the past year or so. The soft landing, though, in the US still very much in play. And I think the reasons for that is it has to do with the unique nature of this cycle, and in particular that the disruption caused by the pandemic affected principally the supply side of economies. And as the supply side has healed, that means that there had to be less of a squeeze in demand in order to reduce price pressures. So yes, a soft landing in the US, it has to do, I think, is rooted in the unusual nature of this cycle, but broad stagnation in Europe. Now, in the case of Europe, I think as we get to the second half of this year, we should expect to see a slight improvement in conditions, in particular because real incomes growth should start to improve. I don't think it's going to be a spectacular recovery, but some of that pressure on households will start to ease over the second half of this year. And we should start to see a pickup in activity in Europe as a result.
Yes, and you and Andrew Kenningham were talking on the podcast last week about Germany's economic situation and structural headwinds that the economy faces there. and this longer period of stagnation. But based on what you've just said, do we see US outperformance continuing?
Yes, I think this period of US exceptionalism, particularly in a macro sense, will continue. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One is that fiscal policy will remain a bit more supportive in the US, I think, than it will be the case in Europe. Households' balance sheets in the US are looking particularly healthy. And of course, although the terming out of debt and the locking in of low interest rates has helped to blunt the impact of monetary tightening across advanced economies, that's been particularly the case in the US, where we saw this rush to refinance genuine 30-year fixed-rate mortgages at low interest rates during the pandemic era. And so households have been shielded to a much greater extent from higher interest rates in the US than is the case in Europe and elsewhere. So to put all that together, I think that period of US exceptionalism continues, but I think that by the same token, the outperformance of the US economy in relative terms, I think probably narrows a bit because, as I say, we'll start to get a pickup in Europe over the second half of this year.
Another important takeaway that I wanted to draw attention to from the global economic outlook, going back to this question of inflation, the report talks about how we think price pressures are going to ease faster in the UK than in the Eurozone or the US for that matter. What's behind that and what does that mean for the Bank of England? Is it going to be in position to cut rates before the Fed and the ECB?
Well, I think part of it is the fact that inflation rose further and faster in the UK than in other advanced economies. So now those base effects are unwinding, and in particular, the effect of higher energy prices, household utility prices, is starting to drop out of the annual comparison. That's having the effect of pulling down inflation in the UK to a far greater extent than elsewhere. So it's partly an artifact of what's happened in the past rather than what's happening right now. But by the same token, the UK economy is clearly not in a good place. Demand conditions are pretty weak. We're seeing the labour market cool. Month-on-month wage gains are slowing quite sharply now. Put all that together, I think the kind of underlying inflation picture is improving. And of course, interest rates have been increased to well above what most people would regard as a neutral kind of level. Now, very difficult to pin down exactly what neutral is, but I don't think anyone seriously thinks that it's 5% plus in nominal terms in the UK. So I think that helps to explain why inflation in the UK has further to fall and will fall a bit faster than most anticipate. By the same token, it also means that the Bank of England is likely to cut interest rates by more than the market is currently pricing in.
Finally, I've got a study in contrast for you. There was a meeting this past week in Beijing between Xi Jinping and US business leaders. That includes Stephen Schwarzman from Blackstone. Xi was talking up the openness of China's economy and welcoming investment back into the country. Tim Cook was in China the week before, opening a flagship Apple store in Shanghai, also talking up more investment in China. At the same time as all of this is going on, the US and UK in the past week imposing sanctions on Chinese state-affiliated hackers. And that just adds to this growing pressure on Western governments to act more forcefully in recognizing this apparent national security threat that comes from China. So, I mean, from an investment perspective, can these two contradictory ideas exist? That you have China as an attractive investment market, an attractive place to do business for Western firms, but also China as an opponent to the West in a new cold-ish war. Is this contradiction sustainable?
I think that's the key question. I think the thing that we've seen very demonstrably over the past 6 months or so is that both sides, both the US and China, have stepped back and cooled down some of the heated rhetoric that we had seen at the height of the pandemic in kind of 2022 and early 2023 around fracturing, around US-China fracturing. So there's been a concerted effort, I think, on both sides to dial down tensions, to offer olive branches, and to cool down rhetoric. Obviously, Xi and Biden met in San Francisco late last year, and now over the past week, meetings of senior US business people with Xi in Beijing. So all of that's good. All of that's clearly good news and it's progress. I don't think it means, however, that fracturing is a thing of the past and that we're moving back to a world of kind of multilateralism and cooperation. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, as you say, the underlying issues have not gone away. At the same time that we've had this kind of, to great fanfare, these meetings in Beijing, there's been this covert cyber warfare happening under the surface and the sanctions placed on Chinese hackers by the US and the UK. Also, I don't think fundamentally either the political, geopolitical or economic drivers of fracturing have gone away. I mean, the key point is still that China has emerged as a geopolitical rival to the US, a strategic rival to the US, and that will continue to fan the flames of fracturing. And also the economics has changed as well. Remember, we spoke a few weeks ago about how China's trade surplus with the rest of the world has increased as a share of global GDP, and is now running close to the levels that we saw prior to the global financial crisis, so close to a record high. So clearly, if you're Donald Trump, you're thinking about a second term. The fact that China's trade surplus has rebounded globally and China has invested huge amounts in this industrial capacity that is now being exported, I think that sets up a potential battleground over the next 6 to 12 months too. So roll the clock forward. I don't think there's any inconsistency, by the way, of Apple trying to sell products in China. It will continue to do that. It's a major corporation. That's its job. However, I think it's more about the response of governments. It's interesting that Beijing has actually banned the use of Apple phones in its government departments. So I think it's the actions of governments rather than the actions of companies that we should think about. Governments will continue to say we're open for business. It looks like they're going to continue to offer olive branches to one another, but the underlying drivers of fracturing have not gone away. And I think we'll continue to see that play out over the coming years.
That was Neil Shearing talking about Baltimore, our latest global economic outlook, inflation, central banks and fracturing. On Baltimore, watch out for our commodities and US weekly reports. They're going to highlight risks to coal supply and the US economy, respectively. There's also our shipping disruption dashboard that's being updated to highlight supply chain risks. The data underlying that is available to clients of CE Advanced. That's our premium platform. I'll link to all of that stuff on the podcast page as it's published. We'll be continuing to keep a close eye on developments there and bring you the latest in terms of macro risk. I'll also link to the Global Economic Outlook on the podcast notes, as well as links to our work on fracturing. There'll be a drop-in, that's one of our short-form online briefings, all about the Global Economic Outlook on the 11th of April, so you can get your answers about that report from the team direct. Before that, on 4th of April, we're holding a special session all about the outlook for Chinese equities. They've come off the boil a bit in the last few weeks, but they have staged a pretty strong comeback since the start of this year. Tom Matthews and Julian Evans-Pritchard will be talking about what to expect from Chinese share prices, from valuations and earnings, but also this geopolitical angle that Neil was talking about. We run loads of these drop-in sessions each month. They're only 20 minutes long. They're designed to get you the answers you need in as short a time as possible. You can find details of all of them at our website, capitaleconomics.com/events. Now, this November's big election is happening in the US, but it's being watched worldwide, not least in Mexico and Canada. Jason Tuvey from our EM team and Stephen Brown, who leads our Canada coverage, have just published separate reports about the risks surrounding a Trump re-election to the Mexican and Canadian economies. We thought it'd be a good idea to get them together to talk through these risks, and here's that conversation now. It begins with Jason, who's talking about the risks posed by Trump to the USMCA. That's the trade pact signed between the US, Canada, and Mexico in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've seen the suggestions that Trump will implement a 10% universal tariff. Given USMCA, there seems to be this expectation that both Mexico and Canada, for that matter, will be exempt. But this is Trump. We can't rule anything out. And if he were to impose this 10% universal tariff that he's talking about, then Mexico is clearly one of the most vulnerable economies globally, let alone among emerging markets, to that. For its worth, Mexico actually overtook China last year to become the largest exporter of goods to the US. And those exports are around a third of Mexico's GDP, so very large. Now, I know on the US side of things, we've estimated that Trump pushes through this universal tariff. We expect US imports to fall by around 5%. That would lead to roughly 1.5% drop in Mexican GDP if we saw a similar drop in Mexican export. But it could potentially be a lot larger given the threat of significant tariff accumulation. So in other words here, what we're saying is, yes, there might be a 10% tariff, but given the supply chain linkages between Mexico and the US, the effect of tariffs could quite quickly be magnified. given how many times goods can cross the border as part of those supply chains. Even if Mexico were exempted, we doubt that would be the end of the matter. It's pretty clear that Mexico's ties with the US on trade would be on much shakier ground under Trump, particularly given his focus on drugs and immigration and the border.
Yeah, I think there's really just so much uncertainty here, right? Because let's just say, as a given, Trump did put a 10% import tariff on, that we think Canada and Mexico should be exempt because of the existence of the USMCA. But we just don't know when that could become an issue again. So one thing that's clear is that the free countries actually have to renegotiate the terms or kind of recommit to the trade agreement again in 2026. So even if Trump puts his sights immediately on China to begin with, say, and doesn't sort of start tensions with Canada and Mexico, then it's going to come up sooner or later. And I think, again, Trump, maybe it doesn't make sense to withdraw. I think, you know, when what we saw last time is at US Congress, there's obviously a lot of support for the trade agreement, not least because it would be so disruptive to many sort of red states as well, especially if Canada and Mexico responded with any of their own tariffs. But it's still all this huge amount of uncertainty, particularly when it comes to those supply chains, because we don't know the extent to which the tariffs would be imposed on, you know, goods every time they cross the border or just the finished goods. From Canada's perspective, goods exports alone to the US are also worth 20% of GDP. These are huge exposures by the standards of most countries, right? It's such a integrated sort of North American economy. So certainly very, very big risks. But I mean, one part of this maybe is that Mexico and Canada could, in some instances, benefit from some of these kind of proposals we've heard from Trump. We have obviously heard that Trump might want to put a 60% import tariff on imports from China, which, you know, perhaps there could be some benefits to Mexico in that situation. What does your analysis show?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, yes, Mexico could stand to benefit. I know our China team has said that a 60% tariff on China could lead to a drop in Chinese exports to the US of around 30% or so. So it would clearly present an opportunity for Mexican exporters to step in. We've done a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation if Mexico could plausibly boost its exports by around 1.3% of GDP. So roughly similar in size to the hit if Mexico were to find itself subject to a universal tariff. Again, though, it's not quite that simple. For one, you obviously need some spare capacity in the economy to raise output. At the moment in Mexico, there's not much of that, given unemployment is at quite a historically low level. And we've highlighted before, especially when it comes to the talk of nearshoring prospects in Mexico, is actually Mexico's competing with a lot of other countries for a slice of the US market, particularly those in Asia, the likes of Vietnam and Taiwan, for example. And another thing to bear in mind is it looks like any effort by Chinese firms to use Mexico as a base for production looks like that would prompt a backlash from Trump. He's recently threatened to impose tariffs on autos produced by Chinese firms in Mexico. But yeah, I think like you say, this raises a good point, right? For all the talk of the downside risks from another Trump term, both for Canada and Mexico, there might actually be some benefits too. I know that's something you've tried to highlight too with Canada, right?
Yeah, so I think it's certainly when we look at the renegotiated USMCA, so for sort of a provisional minimum wage in the motor vehicle sector, help make Canada more attractive for producers. And certainly we've seen some motor vehicle plants being retooled because Canada is a much more attractive destination now to make those investments because of that extra provision. So it's not a huge economic boost, but the Canadian government estimated that the new terms are actually worth kind of a quarter of a percent of GDP for Canada. So considering how stressed out we were about the negative implications during the renegotiations, it actually ended up being quite good. And another part benefit for Canada in particular was kind of the impact on immigration. So Trump took a much tougher stance, not just on sort of the illegal part of immigration, but also the Trump administration made it harder for sort of visa applications more generally. And so Canada capitalized on that, offered visas and a route to permanent residency, specifically for the HB1 US visa holders, particularly in the tech sector. So that benefited Canada. And that would be quite good, I think, going forward, because there's quite a lot of concern when it comes to, say, AI professionals and sort of academics, that those people might be tempted into the US. Whereas if the backdrop is a bit more sort of anti-immigrant, then perhaps those people are more likely to come to Canada or stay in Canada. I guess it's, you know, it is a different issue though with Mexico, right? And the tensions on the border and how that might be resolved.
Yeah, it's a much bigger issue, I think. And there's various ways that could play out. We've seen Trump, for example, has threatened to tighten border restrictions. He could even shut the border completely in a sort of worst-case scenario. That would clearly threaten supply chain disruptions. And it could be Trump also not necessarily imposes tariffs on Mexico related to a universal tariff, but actually in other areas where there are company disputes with the Mexican authorities, not only related to drugs and immigration, but things like content requirements for autos, genetically modified corn, or even energy policy.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the concerns for me from a Canadian perspective, is that even if there's not a really outright threat of a withdrawal from a USMCA, we get all this uncertainty about all these different parts of the agreement that might be renegotiated. And again, maybe we can make the case that some of them end up benefiting Canada, but it's the continued uncertainty about the risks of investing in a production plant in Canada rather than just doing that in the USA, where obviously companies would be shielded from future disagreements. So it's, yeah, certainly a downside risk that investors need to be on the watch for both the Canadian and in particular the Mexican perspective, as you say. So, yeah, one additional uncertainty here from the Canadian perspective is that we do have a federal election coming up in Canada as well, probably not until October 2025 when it's due. But that could be a game changer in terms of the US-Canadian relationship, because we did see that Trump had a particularly frosty relationship with Justin Trudeau under the current Liberal government in Canada, whereas the opposition Conservatives are projected to take a majority in the next election. They've proposed policies that are probably much more similar to what the Trump administration would favour itself. For instance, the Conservatives have proposed scrapping the Canadian carbon tax. They'd be a lot friendlier towards things like the oil and gas sector. So it might be that we end up with a bit of a rocky relationship to begin with, but then when this new Canadian government likely comes in, that kind of settles tensions down a bit. But what could be the case in Mexico with a forthcoming election there?
Yeah, so we have the elections in Mexico in a few months in June. So AMLO's 6-year term is up. Looks low. His party, Morena, and its presidential candidate, Claudia Sheinbaum, they're well ahead in the polls. So it'd be a big shock now if she didn't secure the presidency and Morena didn't secure a majority. Now, I mean, by and large, it looks like she will look to build on AMLO's legacy. She's not really said much about the US at this stage, other than that she will look to take advantage of nearshoring opportunities. I guess one thing here, particularly when it comes to Trump, is quite a lot often comes down to personal relationships. You mentioned with Trudeau in Canada. Now, actually, despite being opposite ends of the political spectrum, Trump and AMLO actually appeared to get on quite well. I guess at this stage, we really don't know if a similar relationship will build between Sheinbaum and Trump. But she's obviously following AMLO in terms of it's quite left-wing. I think one element also that might lead to some tension is she's actually quite climate-friendly in terms of her ideology. She was part of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning group at the IPCC. So, yeah, that could end up being an area of tension between her and Trump and May. Lead to broader tensions in the Mexico-US relationship.
And again, that's not good news for Canada, because as we saw during the first NAFTA renegotiations, even if Trump's main issue is with some part of a trade relationship with Mexico, Canada ends up just being collateral damage because of that existence of the three-party trade agreement.
That was Stephen Brown talking to Jason Tuvey about Trump, Canada and Mexico. We've the motherload of analysis about the risks around this election on a dedicated page on our website. I will link to that in the podcast notes, and a link to a recording of our recent drop-in all about the risks around the US election. Check those out. But that's it for this week. Neil and I are out next week, and the EM team will be taking over the podcast to highlight key risks to emerging markets investing. That'll be out at the usual time, Monday, 8th of April. But until then, goodbye. Whilst this podcast is provided with all reasonable skill and care, it comprises the subjective views of our economists. Furthermore, these views are not opinions, nor do they constitute investment or financial advice, or are they guarantees or reassurances to the expected results of any investment products or outcome. You should seek your own specific advice in relation to questions you may have. We will have no liability to you in relation to this podcast whatsoever.